Hello there, and a very good morning to you. And you're very welcome to the programme this morning. And surprisingly, there are not that many rugby pictures on the front pages today. There are some, but there's no gloating, do you know? There's just sort of relieved and relief and hope for the future. Anyway, on to the main story. Sunday Independent. Rent crisis, first sign of slowdown. Now, that might cheer a lot of people up. Mind you, I suppose it would depress others. But first easing off for 3 years. Supply and caps key, say the experts, and tenants can't afford anymore, is the other point made there. They also have US immigration grills Casey over Aris campaign, and apparently his remarks that if he won, that he'd give up his green card. Obviously, they took offence at that. But anyway, the Sunday Times, Harris to correct the oil record on the National Children's Hospital to save job, they say. And he's quoted further down. No, I'll come to that later. Talks on nurses' pay heat up as thousands march in support. And Soros gave 50,000 to civil liberties chief. And they go through the various contributions that Soros has made to kind of public bodies and non-profits here. The Sunday Business Post, Labour leader pushes government access for big tobacco firms. Howlin and Fine Gael's noon among politicians canvassed by the industry. And crackdown on state pensions nets 15 million for the Exchequer. The Irish Mail on Sunday, Harris's sorry, that's in inverted commas, as the blame game spreads, Health Minister ready to correct record of the Dáil. And we have a gangster who's very, very cross indeed because the staff in the prison removed a mobile phone that he uses to run an empire. So he's not a happy camper or indeed a happy prisoner. And the Sunday World has the story on that most recent shooting. Heartbroken wife pays tribute to family man who lived for kids. There's a more aggressive headline that we'll kind of leave aside for the moment. Now, can I introduce our panel this morning? Alan Barrett, director of the ESRI, Maureen Gaffney, psychologist and author, John O'Brennan, Jean Monnet, professor of European integration in Maynooth. You have your work cut out for you in the future, don't you? I just say that as an aside, given the stories today. Patricia Hughes, midwifery and nursing consultant, and Kevin Doyle, group political editor with INM. And you are all very, very welcome indeed. Maureen Gaffney, I'll go to you first because there are so many stories today about the all of health, the HSE, the nurses and indeed the hospital. Now, you were on the first board of the HSE.
Yes.
And what was the plan then?
The plan then was to, there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the local health boards because there was politicians on them, you know, huge number of representatives, and there was an enormous amount of political interference. That was one of the consistent complaints. And there was a lot of, you know, they were all sort of little empires unto themselves, and there was a very dysfunctional system at the time, you know, with the what we used to call shroud waving, you know, where the hospitals would spend everything, you know, at the beginning of the year. And then November, coming up to the flu season, they'd say, you know, they'd wave the shroud and the Department of Health would give in. And so it was entirely dysfunctional. The idea was on foot of a report that the solution was to set up a sort of an integrated national system.
That was the
system.
Brennan report, was
yeah.
it?
Yeah. That's what happened. So Micheál Martin appointed the first board in 2004, and we did all the preparatory work as much as we could. And it went live on the 1st of January 2005. I think if I look back on that board, I think it actually achieved an awful lot. I mean, we discovered that there was no data really at a national level. So that was one of our first jobs, is to see what's actually going on. And we began to compare and contrast, you know, hospitals that would have the same case mix, the same kind of resources and so on, and found that some were fantastic, some weren't doing so well. Now, that actually was very, very useful. And it also set up a kind of a peer competition, you know, so hospitals didn't want to be the, you know,
bottom
sort
of
well, in comparison to ones that they thought of as like themselves. We did a huge amount of preparation for the Children's Hospital, and we had selected on the foot of, you know, consultancy reports about traffic and all the rest. We had selected out of all of the options, and boy, were there options. And we did it, you know,
you
completely.
Had selected which?
We decided in advance what the criteria were, and then we didn't know which hospital met them. We just got the data and we selected the Mater because it had met all the criteria. And if that hospital had gone ahead, we would now have a world-class children's hospital, fully functioning. And it didn't. Bord Pleanála had objections,
yeah.
And then, you know, it then got into the crazy cycle of, you know, of back into the, you know, the dogfight about where it should be and should it be on the M50 and all that stuff.
So when was that about?
When was that? That would have been, the board sort of is a 4-year cycle.
Right.
And then there was, you know, things continue,
vaguely
progress, things. And then the James Riley then decided that he was going to abolish the board. I mean, there was a very interesting interview yesterday you did with Tony O'Brien. I thought it was fascinating, you know, where he said that in his half of the first, you know, the first 3 years of his 6-year term, he was implementing something that I think he said he didn't agree with anyway. The whole sort of HSE thing wouldn't have been his preferred route. And then right in the middle of the whole thing, you know, it was abolished. And then he had to deal with that. Now, I know from, you know, my time on the board that, and, you know, I worked in the health service for a long time anyway myself, that, you know, we went around the country, we talked to people at every level. We were really, we used to have board meetings actually in sort of, you know, in local hospitals and things.
The interface with politics?
But actually what was interesting was the amount of disruption for staff each time there's a big structural change. You know, people don't know where they are. They're completely uncertain about what they're going to be doing, who they're going to be reporting to, etc. And that uses up an enormous amount of their energy, their emotional energy, their cognitive energy. So every structural change, you know, it uses up calories in the system.
Right.
The interface with politics is always very complex because theoretically the Department of Health are the people who make the
policy,
the overall policy, and the HSE is the body that implements it. But anyone who has ever worked anywhere will know that, you know, the interface between the two is not neat. You know, people who are making the policy have to have an awful lot of very good communication with those who are actually implementing it.
Right.
There needs to be a feedback loop. So there's always a bit of...
I gather Micheál Martin and yourselves worked well. And Mary Harney.
Mary Harney, yeah. Mary Harney
but
was very active.
But she took a lot
minister.
Of flack.
She did. But she was a very good minister in the sense that she knew, she was very clear about what she wanted. And she was kind of hands-on, you know. So she wasn't sort of there and you had to go through 10 layers, you know. Yes, I mean, I think
but
it's always messy.
Say
it's always messy.
That the fact that Bertie agreed with the unions not to move anybody or not
well,
to...
Well, this is part of it because the government at the time in 2004, you know, when we were setting up, as it were, you know, before we went live, when we were setting up the structures, the government at the time made an agreement with the unions, with the Impact Union, about all kinds of things. You know, that's their total legitimate right. But one of the things that they agreed was that people, for example, wouldn't have to move unless they wanted to. And we were left in a situation where appointments had been made at a very senior level. But then, you know, there was all kinds of fussing, like, because the people in place were also going to continue to be paid the same way. And also the people that we appointed were sometimes at the other end of Ireland and would stay there. And
okay.
And so the head of a particular service, for example, might be, you know, at the very extreme of Ireland.
Yeah.
And would have to be coming up and down,
right,
three, four times
so
a week.
Here so. We are today. Do you think that the government should give in to the nurses' pay claim?
I think the nurses have... And the GPs, I'll add as well, and junior doctors, all of those, I think they're under extraordinary stress. The morale is on the floor.
Do you think they should give in to them?
I think some. There's going to have to be some deep engagement with all of them. I think Tony O'Brien said yesterday that you know, that general practice as we know it, you know, which is the centre yeah. of any future progressive policy, is not going to be there in very short time. I think the nurses have legitimate claims. Now, obviously,
okay.
the pay thing is going to be difficult.
Yeah.
But
Alan Barris,
there'll be ways, I'm sure.
I gather you don't think they should give in to the pay claims.
Well, I'm not sure who told you that.
My brief. I read it last night.
Okay, well, let me put it in a more nuanced sort of way. I mean, look, everybody, and the newspapers kind of captured this very, very well today. Everybody understands that what nurses do is absolutely fantastic. Everybody understands the pressures they're working under. And I think, you know, instinctively, you look at this group of people and instinctively you say, of course, they have a case. But I think Pascal Donoghue talked about this very, very eloquently during the week. And I'm reminded, again, just a small point. I remember being in the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform one day from an ESRI perspective. But the point that was being made to me was that everybody who comes in the door of the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform begins with the line that there's something special about them, that they completely understand that the government finances have to be managed very, very tightly, but here is a special case. And I was actually interested to listen to Maureen there, because it started at the nurses and soon you're onto the GPs and everybody else. And, you know, so there is a great, great difficulty here, without a shadow of a doubt, I think, for the government, which is if they give in here, the potential knock-on effect is quite important. And just to, again, develop a little bit further, I know the nurses' union seem to be making the case, and apologies to them if I misquoted, but there is a sort of an argument that, well, one of the ways to pay for the pay claim will be that there will be savings in terms then of agency nurses.
Right.
And it's all this, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric here, and sometimes if a little bit frustrating, where the argument is, oh, we're going on strike for the sake of the system. And this is all about patient safety. And while it might be at some sort of a level, you know, it's about money. So they're clearly arguing that, well, if you do this, you know, you will have more nurses will stay, recruitment will be easier, and you'll save on the agency nurses. But of course, if you're the Minister for Finance, I mean, you know what the pay cost is going to be, and then the hoped for savings may or may not arise. I mean, I'm not sure if the sort of thing, you know, the amounts of money you're talking about are going to be such that it's going to transform.
Yeah.
So I think there's a huge, huge difficulty here for the for the department. I noticed in the paper today there was a good article about, and I thought this phrase has gone out of fashion, but they might be able to solve this through allowances.
Okay? Yeah.
Now, again, this was an old technique.
Yeah.
But just a word of warning to the nerve, if they go down that, you know, you might keep your allowance for 10 years, but we remember during the downturn, one of the first things that was looked at was, you know, who's getting all these allowances.
Right.
So anyway, I'll let my colleagues talk for a minute about this too.
Yeah, if I can come to you, Patricia, midwife and nursing consultant. You have worked extensively, both as a nurse and a midwife. Give us a clue of where, how,
so
when.
So about just over 30 years in the health services, 10 in England and the rest predominantly in Ireland, but I've also worked in New Zealand. My last 20 years have been in management roles in Cavan, Cork and the Coombe Women and Infants Children's Hospital. The last 12 years I was at Director of Midwifery Nursing level in both the Coombe and in Cork, the Unified Maternity Services. Right. So
what's your perspective on this?
Well, obviously, you're going to say I'm biased, but my...
Of course you are.
That's the experience I come from. I believe the midwives and nurses' claims are valid. I hear what people say, it's about nursing, it's about pay, but it's about patient safety. ultimately this is about patient safety. Certainly over the last 10 years I've seen a really deteriorating picture of recruitment and retention. And I refer there to the article in Sunday Business Post by Susan Mitchell this morning about the claim of one applicant for every four nursing
That's
posts.
That's right, and she says not so.
And she says not so is right. But I don't know where she got that information from. I am tired of just looking at one side of the information. From my experience, you will get lots of applicants for every post. The problem is how many feet on the ground do you get at the end of the day? I can give the example of 1 year in my post as Director of Midwifery Nursing. I held recruitment competitions once a month because we were desperately looking for midwives and neonatal nurses, theatre nurses and gynaecology nurses. And we would interview maybe 10 to 12 people a day once a month. And these were all the applicants we got in. Predominantly, we would offer posts to most of them. However, the yield was about one midwife or nurse per competition. So at the end of that year, I can tell you that I had actually given a contract and it was accepted to 31 people. And in that same year, I lost 32. And I had lost 12 days of interviewing and numerous days of shortlisting and going through applications. And you will get this. You'll get applicants from all parts of the world, from the Middle East, from Asia, from the Americans, Australia, Canada. How many of them make it over and actually take up that contract? And I see in the Daily Mail...
Can I just go back to what Susan Mitchell was writing about? Because it took me aback. And she said that on one competition, where they were looking for, I think it was 500,
six applicants, that amount applied. And that is exactly my experience, because you will get all sorts of applications online, but that is not the same as the yield of the feet on the floor at the end of the process. And so these figures are interesting, but what's more interesting is what is the yield? I have heard yesterday at the rally that we're 1,700 midwives and nurses short on what we were in 2007. At the same time, I hear the HSE saying that they've employed 3,500 midwives and nurses. We need the two figures. We need the recruitment and we need the actual net effect of that on the ground.
Right.
In my experience, it has been less and it has been deteriorating over the last 10 years.
Okay.
And that is definitely impacting on concerns around safety for patients.
Right.
So I do think
Can I just give you one caller was on to say, Marion, let's not hear any more guff about angelic nurses. By escalating this dispute to 3 days, they're putting us patients at risk, and this is outrageous. And another one says, Marion, in hospitals, doctors diagnose, but nurses keep us alive. So that's the two sides of the coin.
Yeah.
But there is one fundamental fact that people keep ducking and diving around. You shook hands on a deal. You agreed to an agreement that wouldn't run out until 2020. Now, we see trying to do a deal with Mrs. May has its own problems if people can't deliver and live up to their word. But this was agreed and voted on.
Yes. I appreciate that, and I'm not obviously from the union, but I'm not speaking on behalf of the union, I'm speaking independently. And, you know, I understand the public's concern about that, but this is a moving and a deteriorating situation. I know that when the Pay Commission was set up and there was a questionnaire poll, the questions were narrowed to the point of people weren't really asked about many questions around pay and conditions, and the situation is moving all the time.
Okay.
I think that's what we have to work on.
John O'Brien, I should say.
Firstly, we should acknowledge, I think, that nurses don't go on strike. Historically, they have been much less inclined to take this kind of action than other groups, teachers, for example. The first nurses' strike took place almost 20 years ago in 1998-99. So this is unusual. We should, I think, acknowledge that. The second thing is that nursing itself has changed very significantly. And I think part of the gripe that nurses have in particular is that because they are now trained to degree level, that isn't adequately matched if you look at their pay structures.
But
and
you
relative
see, there
to
are lots
groups.
Of people who do degrees and get paid different money.
Sure, but
you
I think
know,
their point is
you know, if you do a degree in
been...
engineering, you mightn't get the same pay as somebody who did a degree in something else. So, I mean, everybody that gets a degree does not get paid the same amount of money.
That is true. But I think what they're arguing is that relative to where they were before the introduction of the undergraduate system, there really hasn't been very much change, and certainly not enough to actually match with what nurses do on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
But the more important issue, I think, is about the conditions that nurses
yes.
are working in.
Yeah.
If you've got a single day where there are 500 people on trolleys in Irish hospitals and nurses are trying to navigate their way through all of that and to do their jobs with coherence and so on, it's enormously difficult.
And you know, because you've had hands-on
experience. I have, yes. My father has been in hospital in recent weeks, so I've watched as nurses and other medical professionals have gone about their business in the wards, and it remains hugely impressive. But you always sort of wonder whether charts are being read correctly about, you know, whether the information flow is as good as it could be. And very often that's something that's compromised, and families really do appreciate that.
It's very difficult. Can I come back to the politics of all of this? Now, that will obviously also include the hospital. And we see that, well, it's in the papers that Harris is going to make a statement, and Thal and Leo Varadkar has said he expected it. Politically, say with Pascal Donoghue's perspective, how are they going to go about this, Kevin?
Yeah, I think any time it gets into a public sector strike, it immediately becomes a PR game from the two sides. So it's almost like a referendum to see, do the public back the nurses or do they back the government? And that's, I think, what we're seeing here. And up to this point, I think the nurses have been winning that, and I think the government are acutely conscious that the nurses have. But I think this week is a game changer, because if they go out Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, that's 3 days in a row. And I think two things happen there. One is that's the hospitals in all sorts of mire. It's
right.
not day on, day off. But also for the nurses' point of view, that'll be 6 days without pay. And you're getting, for people who are saying they have money problems, you're now getting to a stage where they're going almost a week without pay. And then in the background, the backdrop to all this is the row over the children's hospital.
Right.
So Simon Harris and Pascal Donoghue need this to go away.
Right. Well, we've another caller in. To walk out on sick patients is not the way to go. So, I mean, the worm can turn in these things.
The longer it goes on,
a member
that
of
shift,
your family. Yeah. Yes.
That shift, the longer this goes on, that shift will start to happen. That's why I think the 3 days back to back will, I think, have some sway on public opinion, because it isn't a case of, okay, well, it stopped for a little bit and we got going again, and it stopped for a little bit. 3 days is a long time if you're in that hospital setting, and that, I think, is going to be crucial.
Right.
But the nurses also know that Simon Harris and Pascal Donoghue have all sorts of other problems going on, so they are weakened at the minute.
Okay. We've Dan O'Brien pointing out you have to borrow this money if you're going to pay it, and it's going to be ongoing.
Well, one of the
yes,
points
Maura, you wanted to come in and then I go.
The thing is, though, that one, it's just like it's becoming a poll, you know, about who's more popular. There's also the issue that once you get into trade union negotiations, money, you know, is sort of part of the rhetoric and the narrative. But there's a whole lot of other stuff that has to be sorted out. I mean, money in some ways is symbolic of that this is a system, I think, for doctors and nurses. They're working a system that is under severe stress, and that affects the quality of their work. We have good scientific evidence about this. It affects, you know, the care they give patients because they're so stressed themselves, and particularly if they're looking after very sick patients, and it affects the speed of, you know, doctors' accurate diagnosis, the number of options they can come up with for treatment. There's very good scientific evidence. It's not just like all about touchy-feely, do the nurses feel happy.
Alan, can I come to you?
Yeah, no, just to pick up on the point, and Kevin made it that in the public sector strikes, ultimately really are about public relations, okay?
And yes.
Again, if you're in a company and you're going on strike, the person who suffers is the company, because profits are down. So the dynamics of public sector strikes are quite different. And on this one, I'm just sort of slightly surprised about the nurses' union tactics for a couple of reasons. So one is just with Brexit hanging out there, It's like, I think, both a reasonable timing, argument yeah. to make on the part of the Minister for Public Finance that it would be wholly irresponsible at this particular point to say that we'll give in to this. So I think the timing of that just sort of seemed to
it
surprise me.
It fits with
just
the old union chant, what do we want, when do we want it? We're yeah. fine with what they want, but it's when they want
it. That was but the other thing then, and again, this links to something John was talking about, because to the extent that it's not a sort of a pay award like that, we just want an extra 10% because we think we're great, but it's around relativities. That one of the points I would have thought they would have argued runs along the following lines, and I'm going to link it to sort of gender and the fact that nursing is a very gendered occupation, mm-hmm. that we know increasingly that the gender pay gap doesn't really arise because men and women doing the same job are paid differently. Mm-hmm. It's because men and women tend to do different jobs. And again, listening to Phil Nihay and others during the week, it seems to be this notion that, again, as nursing has increased in terms of professionalism degree requirements, that there is now a sort of a disconnect between what they're being paid and other comparable occupations. And I would have thought that, you know, the case could be made that maybe that is partly because you have a female-dominated occupation, yeah. which traditionally has been undervalued to yeah. some certain extent. And I suppose what I'm making here is that if I was in the nurses' union, these are the sort of, I think, more perhaps appealing public relations-type arguments. So, you know, both appealing, but also perhaps at a different time.
Right. Okay, I want to move on to the hospitals and the kind of disaster that has emerged there. And Kevin, you raised the point about the cost overruns and the cost estimates and all of that, and how unrealistic the estimates seemed to have been. And you figured that we're asking the wrong questions.
I think there's an element, and you know, if you go through, we've very much gone into the politics of it, and it's very much, even if you read a lot of what's in the papers today, it's all about Simon Harris, and the headlines are all about Simon Harris. Will he go? Won't he go? Will Fianna Fáil pull the plug on him? Will Sinn Féin divide Fianna Fáil over it? So it's the political games. But I'm not sure that bumping Simon Harris out of there would achieve an awful lot, because... And I think Fianna Fáil have perhaps learned this from the Dennis Nocton scenario. I think Philip Ryan makes that argument in a piece he has in the Sun Independent, that once Dennis Nocton was gone on the broadband controversy, we all moved on. Yeah. The media moved on, the politicians moved on, the experts moved on. And so we never actually really got to the bottom of what all happened there and how we ended up with one bidder, because there was a political head and a plate and we moved back to talking about
Brexit. Well, the head on the plate seems to be kind of the fashion at the moment.
Yeah, very much so. And what's happened, the questions here in terms of the hospital is, how on earth we ended up in a scenario where one bidder put in the lowest bid, that 75% of the tender bit marking went on the cost and only 25% on deliverability and quality. And we now end up in a sense where you can win it by putting in the lowest bid, but then you can come back afterwards and ratchet up millions and millions and millions and millions. And us as the taxpayers are left going, well, we've no choice to pay it now. It's too big to fail. There's already a hole in the ground out at St James's.
Yeah, but it's a good hole in the ground. It could be used for something else. They only started building the hospital this week.
Arguably, but I think a bit like Maureen said before, and we'd sit back in this studio in 5 years' time and go, well, if we had built it at James's, we'd now have one of the best hospitals
yeah,
in the world.
Yeah.
And we'd be back to square
but,
one.
But if you have to stop the galloping horse.
Yeah, but that's the question. Is perhaps this now is too big to fail, but are the lessons going to be learned for future, for projects like this? Because we're going to see a metro in a few years. Are we going to come back and do the same thing where some company bids for a metro and tells us it's going to cost 900 million and we end up paying 2 billion?
Patricia?
I think the too big to fail is terrible, because everything can fail. And I think that what the children have waited and their families have waited decades for, a children's hospital, the most expensive hospital in the world or anywhere near,
does not
necessarily mean anything like a good hospital, never mind a world-class hospital. I think it is time to take a pause on this and to do a very detailed examination of every aspect of the decision-making. You can't keep throwing good money after bad. And in the context of the nurses' strike, it is very hard to tell nurses and midwives we can't afford it and Brexit is coming. Meanwhile, we're happy to spill away parts of billions
with
of euros.
With capital, they will say.
Yes, but it's money. It's taxpayers' money. It is the man and the woman on the ground who are paying into this. So it's not acceptable. And the public can't be expected to trust that it will be the best hospital in the world because it's the most expensive.
Okay.
They need well-planned, well-governed, well-managed, well-equipped, well-staffed. And we have no expectation of that happening just because it's expensive.
Maureen?
I think, you see, the heart of this is that we don't do accountability well in Ireland. We've gone from one extreme to the other. It's not so long ago when, honestly, nobody ever resigned, no matter what they were found doing. And now we've gone right to the other side, where the only thing we have now is bloodlust, you know. I mean, the stuff in the papers today is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I'll come back to that. But once then we have the head on the plate, we lose all interest in the whole thing. And we're not prepared to engage with the detail of things. And there's really good studies that show that it's only some kinds of accountability that are actually effective. Like, looking for someone's resignation is the very back end of it, and it's only one possible outcome. I personally believe Simon Harris shouldn't go. I think it's going to create chaos. The second thing is that we've set up, you have to know how it is you're going to define success. And we know that if you allow people, as it were, to expect that they will be made accountable, but that the audience that's going to make them accountable is well informed and fair,
right,
then people make good decisions. Increasingly, what's happening is that people are expecting a barrage of media attacks from their own party colleagues, from the opposition, etc. And so what's happening in the civil service, all round in the public service, is that people are simply covering their back. They're taking the decision that they believe will be the easiest one to defend to PAC,
okay,
and not the best decision.
Okay, the bit I didn't read out on the front of the page under Harris to correct Dáil, one of the quotes in there, in line with the expenditure profile, should have acknowledged that the guaranteed maximum price of the contract for overground construction had not been finalised. And it seems to me...
Can you mislead by omission? That's the question.
That's at the heart of it. Sorry, John.
One of the other extraordinary things here is, while people have been focusing on what Simon Harris did not tell the Taoiseach and Pascal Donoghue, Pascal Donoghue had actually appointed somebody from his department onto the board, the hospital board.
Right.
So he should have known as early as early September of last year about what the overrun was, this extra 200 million construction cost. He had to know. So it wasn't about whether Minister Harris communicated to Minister Donoghue, his own man was actually on the board, so couldn't not know about the scale of the potential overrun.
Picking
the
up something that Maureen said there, I wonder if people are getting very nervous about writing minutes and keeping notes.
Oh, well, all over the correspondence between the Department of Public Service, Public Expenditure and Reform, I mean, it is classic them and health, each covering themselves.
Yeah.
You know, we left a message then, you know, but we did get back to you. I mean, it's...
And it was released in the evening yet again.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think all the focus is on who knew what and when.
Yes, rather
the
than
is,
the essence.
Why did this go so wrong? Where was the planning right at the very beginning? And who was responsible for that at that stage?
Well, I thought it was an extraordinary contract, but I'm assured that the state does those kind of contracts all the time. Now, that really surprised me, because I always thought, and one stage, for though, I worked in this thing, you really try and nail everything down and get your quantities before you pay out a penny.
Well, from a midwifery nursing point of view, trying to get 10 new thermometers an award, you have to go through so many steps and so many signatures. It is extraordinary to people in the health services that this kind of thing can go on.
Alan?
Colm McCarthy has a helpful article on this morning, but I mean, one of the points that Colm makes now, okay, I mean, he's raising questions about the whole how did it happen, but I suppose one of the difficulties of something like a hospital is, like, you know, you build a road
one
all
off
the time, and you have, yeah, so when so obviously you've got two parties in to a contract, and there's risk around the contract, and then it really is a question of sort of sharing the risk and where the burden is going to be. But just to go back to some of the additional issues that were being raised, there's an interesting headline in one of the papers, and it's around this idea: did Simon Harris, you know, not come forward with all the information because he thought it might have been somebody else's problem soon? And this tricked brought another sort of issue to my head. Somebody pointed out to me recently that for a lot of ministers now in the Department of Health, the primary ambition is to get out of the Department of Health.
And
I think one of the differences with Mary Harney, she was probably one of the first ministers
volunteered.
Okay, and I mean, in fairness, James Riley, I think, was another person again who showed a degree of enthusiasm. But I think with this, by definition, there's always going to be crises in health. By definition, it is just a phenomenally difficult department to run, and I think we all understand why. If we are always going to have a culture that demands the head on a plate of whoever that minister is, we are almost guaranteed two situations. A, nobody good will want the job, and B, anybody who goes into it will say, well, hopefully I'll be out of this in six months.
Yeah.
And so, and I think because again, just one more point.
Yeah.
We do have the Sláinte Care blueprint. I mean, one of the sort of positive developments is the there was the Oral Party Oireachtas Committee that produced a plan that I think a lot of people sort of said, yeah, that makes a huge amount of sense. And then, it's in the Department of Health, but over the year, we've had things like the cervical smear controversy.
Yeah.
And let's be clear, I mean, I think some of both the media reaction to it and the political reaction caused a lot of difficulties that, sort of there were problems there, but I mean, it's sort of, attention, I think, got distracted. And the other thing we always have to remember about the Department of Health, while there's the overrun on the Children's Hospital, there's also the annual substantial overrun on the current budget. Mm-hmm. And there's this real battle in the Department of Health every year to keep the hospitals open to December within the budget that they have. And a lot of this is not actually about running things badly. I mean, this is a demand-driven system with a growing population and aging population, and it is very, very difficult.
It's just worth recalling that the overrun last year was 700 million. Now,
we have got so used to using figures like this, it sounds like you just take it out of your handbag.
To give you the comparison, the increase in the budget across the entire education sector for this year was 150 million. So the supplementary increase in the health budget is more than four times the entire increase for primary, secondary and higher education. There's something deeply, deeply wrong at a systemic level there.
Okay, a couple of remarks from our callers. This one, I'd say a lot of people would agree with. The cost of living is driving nurses' claim. Could the HSE build some accommodation and rent it? Old Hollis Street site, Old Crumlin and Temple Street sites, etc., says Anya. And there is a huge element of truth in that, because the cost of renting or the cost of buying a house is so difficult now. If patient safety is important, why do the nurses insist on 12-hour shifts?
Can I answer that? I think this is a huge problem. The 12-hour shifts came in around the late 90s, and they were predominantly based around cost of housing, going up the price of houses and mortgages. So certainly when I came back to Ireland in 1999, there were nurses travelling up from Cavan and that area, working in the Temple Street Children's Hospital. And because they were getting up, they were having to pay for mortgages or rent in Dublin. They were moving out because we're moving out then to the suburbs. They needed to reduce
the
cost of childcare. So they went into 12-hour shifts to reduce the cost of childcare and travel in order to make a living for rent and mortgages.
Briefly, that issue
about looking for ideas elsewhere. One of the things we did was on the board was initiate the cancer strategy, which has been a big success. And we brought Tom Keane over from Canada, who was absolutely fabulous. And he went out to have a look at what was going on, and he went to an outpatient and he saw the usual chaos, hundreds of people all waiting for the same appointment time. And he went up to one of the people and he said, one of the staff, and he said, this doesn't look very satisfactory. What's the solution, do you think? And they said, more staff. I mean, the solution is not more staff. The solution is a better appointment system. And there's loads of places outside health that manage appointment systems.
They do, and they send off texts and all of that kind of thing. It seems, this is again from our listeners, it seems that the nurses are the only ones in the health service. Everyone says they're special, but what about the rest? This position belittles all other clinical and non-clinical staff. Marion, patient safety. My friend has breast cancer operation scheduled for last week, cancelled, and she's frightened. Hospital said oncology and ops would go ahead. what in God's name is going on, says Anne. Another one said, I had sympathy for the nurses' situation until it emerged that they stood by and allowed cancer operations to be cancelled. I'm so upset about this, as I know someone whose operation was cancelled. I think it's just unforgivable. My sister's in hospital, and in spite of the nurses' strike, she's looked after very well. They're so dedicated to their work. They are definitely overworked. They deserve every penny and more that they get. Another one says, you're not comparing like with like. Nurses have loads of days off. 2 days on, 4 days off. They get extraordinary maternity and sick leaves. And on, I could skip the rest of the programme, but I won't. And on that note, with us in studio, Kevin Doyle, Patricia Hughes, John O'Brennan, Maureen Gaffney and Alan Barrett, and back after this.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, caller got on to say, I'm a nurse on duty since early this morning, covering half a county on my own, 30 years qualified, driving my own car for the HSE, paying extra car insurance. I receive net pay of €900 per fortnight. Forgive me if I shout at the radio regarding new hospital versus fair play for my profession. There's the perspective clarified. Now, we're not going to go to Brexit. We are going to look at that extraordinary story about Liam Neeson. And in one sense, you would imagine that it would have gone away, you know, that it would be a one-day wonder, a two-day, except there are fundamental issues in there. Alan, you lived in the States, so you'd have a great immediate consciousness of the kind of awful history that the United States is trying to go out. What was your own reaction to that? And what's your reaction to the coverage?
Well, first reaction is, I mean, I still cannot understand why he said what he did or what he said. Okay, so we might sort of get into the analysis of it a little bit. But again, just a small, I remember I went to Michigan State University. It was 1989. It was nearly, like, it is 30 years ago. And one of the first things we had when we had foreign teaching assistants were given essentially a submersion course in borderline political correctness. And it was just, you know, an awareness that you were taking people from all over Europe and Asia, dropping them in the United States where you'd be teaching classes with black kids and white kids and everything, and just, you know, to make sure there was a sensitivity. So this is 30 years ago. I remember being sort of submerged in this, and I remember too, during the years that I was there, the Michigan State was searching for a new president, and there was an odds on favourite, and somebody took out that about sort of 20 years earlier he had made a comment about around the lines that black people were better, genetically better sports people than white people. Okay, and somebody took this up and he was disqualified for the presidency of Michigan State.
So, well, I mean, did nobody draw their attention to the history of Ethiopia in the Olympics?
Well, all I'm saying is that there is this thing that it is such an incredibly sensitive area that generally people are, you know, sort of sensitized or whatever like that. So to hear somebody like Liam Neeson come out with a remark about wandering the streets thinking he was going to get, you know, find a black person. Yeah, I just found it extraordinary because there's a bit of a sense that, like, you know, once you open that up, you are going to spend roughly the rest of your career explaining precisely what you
and putting
you know, what
it
you
in
meant.
Context.
And trying to put it in context. I mean, it was just such a horrible. Now, some of the discussion around this sort of seems to be along the following lines: that the positive spin is that, well, he was brave because he was admitting that he had this sort of a bias, and maybe we all have these sort
well,
of biases.
Well, it was revenge, it was said.
But it's good in some sense. But I mean, it's almost like, are you saying, like, well, you were a racist at one point, but now you've recovered.
But maybe that happens.
Possibly. But can I just draw a parallel?
Yeah.
And then I'm going to move over because there's people around the table who are much better positioned to talk about this than me. But say if Brett Kavanaugh, when he was at the... Now, he denied he had ever done anything wrong.
Yeah.
But say he had said, well, yeah, I actually did grope this woman, but I didn't really understand all that consent thing, but now I do. you know, would everybody have said, well, good man, Brett, we're going to clap
brave.
You on. Brave. And maybe they would, maybe they would. I don't really know. But this notion of, I had these thoughts and you know, but I kind of got over them.
But
I find it just I don't have a strong view. I think the whole thing raised more questions than anything else.
Yeah, I suppose the thing about anger, and it is human to be angry, particularly if somebody that you know and love has been raped. But I thought Fintan O'Toole did an interesting article on it yesterday, and talking about the raised memory of slavery, just the wrong language. But my understanding of Liam Neeson, and I certainly don't know him, was that he's a UNICEF ambassador, and that he's, you know, so it's all very contrary. What's your take on it, Maureen? You've an article there on it.
Yeah, there's a number of articles, you know, mainly just going through his career and that. I couldn't find any sort of analysis, really. Yesterday, actually, there was an article in the Irish Times, apart from Fintan's, there was an article in the Irish Times just describing, as it were, his Liam Neeson's sort of history on all this. And his history seems to be that he's very impulsive, and that, you know, there's a disconnect between his brain and his larynx, you know, as used to be said about a very famous politician here. And so he has a history of saying nothing now, anything like as offensive as this, but other just stupid stuff. And my take on it is that it was monumentally stupid. I mean, it'd be bad enough just to describe, you know, going out, you know, with a cosh in your hand, looking for someone to, as it were, take out your rage on. But to add the offensive thing about a black bastard, which I believe is the term he used, was really just monumentally offensive and stupid. But I would say it's more, I wouldn't say it's any sign that he's racist. I'd say it's a sign that he definitely has a problem with his impulses, you know. But I would say that this is also a social media storm, which is a completely new phenomenon, you know, where there's just like total, you know, almost hysteria that builds up about things.
Unlike what you were talking about with the politicians.
Well, exactly. And I feel that that kind of contagion is not a good thing, because it makes people don't actually look into what they're doing. And he has said he is sorry. He has said he's deeply ashamed of himself. What do we want him to say? You know,
it was
40 years ago as well.
Yeah, I think the reactions that really matter here are those from people of colour. And I think the Fintan O'Toole piece that you reference is really interesting in that regard. There's one African-American writer that I read almost religiously. His name is Ta-Nehisi Coates, and he's just a wonderful writer, capturing the nuances of what it is to be an African-American at this point in time. But, you know, the people, they'll say, look, we get it. We understand this because we've lived with this all our lives. But on the other hand, there have been some commentators such as John Barnes, the former Liverpool footballer,
yes,
much admired, very thoughtful man, who've said, look, what's really important is that this guy did reflect very seriously on those impulses. He understands that they were wrong, and he feels a sense of shame. And I think that captures, I think, some of the more nuanced reaction in the wake of all the hysteria that Maureen is talking about. I think there is, you know, a sense that he has reflected on what all of that was about and how dreadful it is. It doesn't help, however, that the film he's got coming out this weekend is called Cold Pursuit. Mm-hmm. The next one is called Revenger. So the gap between his life as fiction and reality is really
And being in a character, I mean, I don't know how actors get in and get out of character, but if revenge is what has been engaging your mind...
Yeah. Well, he is almost typecast as this guy. Ever since the Taken movies, his
actor,
persona is that.
You know, and also he talked about an urge to do it. And I would wonder, you know, was he there promoting the movie? And then, you know, maybe
you know, he's sort of slightly exaggerated. Was he really dazed going around
well,
with a caution?
I would wonder. It sounded a little bit like a tall tale. The idea that you would spend 4 days going around with a cosh looking for a black man to start a fight.
To attack you.
Yes. Look, generally, if you go out at night looking for a fight, you will find a fight. That's just law of averages. Anyone who's ever gone out city in the world, if you go out looking for a fight, you'll find a fight.
I've never done that.
just to be clear. But I do question the story a little bit sounds like a little bit of a tall tale. I'm sure there is some element of truth to it, but I wonder maybe in the passing of time, did it become a bigger thing in his head than what actually happened? But I suppose fundamentally on the question, it was racist. He had a racist tendencies. He decided he was going to go out and attack somebody of a colour based on their ethnicity. That's racist. So at one point in his life, Liam Neeson was racist. The question is, does that now end your career at 66 years old? Because a little bit like Alan says, you're always considered an alcoholic. You're a recovering alcoholic once you give up drink and you do therapy and all the rest of it. But for your entire life, it said you should carry that badge of I'm a recovering alcoholic and you don't touch drink. Can you leave the racism behind you 40 years ago? Are you a recovering racist?
Well, on the other hand, sometimes people change their perspectives quite a lot and their thinking on politics, on ideas, evolve.
And
it's called growing up. Do you know what I mean?
That's the question. Can you do that in a scenario like this? Because was it a moment in time? Was it a rush of blood, emotion
to the head.
Driven? Yeah. Because, you know, the context, I think actually what Liam Neeson needs to do is stop doing these 10-minute slots on chat shows.
They have to do it for, and they're a killer for the interviewer too.
You're
getting a headline and you're just trying to explain it away. He actually needs to either sit down and write a big lengthy piece that can run in the New York Times or wherever explaining his thinking. Or he needs to come in maybe, Marion, and sit here with you for an hour on a Saturday.
I was staggered by his comments. I mean, he is an actor, but he is 66 years of age and he has had a long and stellar career. And as you say, ambassador to UNICEF, so he lives in the US. He cannot be immune to the issues of race and race relations. And whilst he was promoting his film, one which was around revenge and the kidnap, I think, of a daughter. And revenge, I think, is an understandable one, and it is understandable to be able to move and grow up through your own emotions. But to use such high voltage language as he did in this 10-minute interview, I think was fairly explosive.
Do you think it was a cynical exercise to get attention for the movie?
I do.
Or that it was just a moment of foolishness, stupidity, call it what you will.
Well, it could be argued as either, and if it was stupidity and all of those, you would wonder about what his mind is doing at this stage, because he's not somebody who hasn't been exposed to these issues already in his life and in where he lives and in the world he works. I noticed that, as you say, John Barnes and Whoopi Goldberg have come to his defence, but that's not helpful to people who work in the Black Lives Matter movement, who are trying to bring around a new consciousness about, you know, equating violence and crime with this colour of skin. And he is just fuel, your words like that fuel that kind of stereotypes. I think people have to be responsible for the words they say and how they fall on the ears.
Yes, Helen.
I know you were trying to avoid Brexit, and we'll avoid Brexit, but can we mention Donald Trump?
Okay, yes,
there is an interesting sort of context here that if Obama was still president and Liam Neeson had said what he said, there might have been a bit of a sense of, well, we've kind of moved on, so let's have this sort of conversation in this very mature way. But in the context now of Trump, and particularly remember his remarks around when there was the white supremacist march, was it
in Virginia?
He talked about, was it whatever?
Decent
he suggested
people.
Anyway, some sort of equivalence. You do wonder and you do worry if the sort of the debate is shifting back a little bit, and that a lot of the sort of progress that was made in the United States, just around, not just about attitudes, but also around language and the careful use of language and all of those sort of things. Was it the case that, you know, while I'm sure Liam Neeson didn't think directly, oh, Donald Trump is president, but has there been a shifting in the overall
permission
context?
Given.
Exactly. Yes. And I think that's just another element that I find
probably won't hurt his career, though. Remember Mel Gibson? I mean, he said far worse things that could be argued about Jewish people in particular.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's been brought back into the Hollywood fold. It's almost like it never happened.
And Roman Polanski got his award in absentia. Listen, we'll leave it there for the moment and we will take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
And thank you very, very much indeed. Now, we're going to move along to another topic, but I'll pepper these through. The nurses must hold tight. Patients have died because of the HSE and politicians' involvement. And there's another one that says, I'm quite unusual here, but I'm frankly furious at nurses. I teach and for years now see colleagues on different pay scales. I see classrooms without teachers. I see students in buildings that are not fit for purpose. We all could do what the nurses do, but forgive us, but we actually do think of our students. And just I have to read this out because it says, that nursing lady is so sound. That's you.
Okay. Thank you.
So we leave that at that. Now, Tony Blair has reiterated his warnings on the consequences of a no deal Brexit, saying it could be devastating for the Northern Ireland peace process. He said no deal will inevitably lead to a really hard border on the island of Ireland and cause a huge split within the UK, and a second Brexit referendum might happen when people see what the true Brexit alternatives are. He said the type of Brexit must be decided before the UK leaves the EU, arguing that a lack of clarity would lead to a lack of closure. The argument goes on and on. Then you'll have left, you'll have paid your money up front, and you'll have given up your negotiating leverage. And on. He was on Sky this morning with Sophie Ridge. Now, we've been joined in studio by a gentleman who tweeted yesterday, Rees-Mogg increasingly blames Ireland for his own Brexit fiasco. Fully understandable he wants to shift blame. His name is set to live in infamy. Sadly, a few will believe his malevolent nonsense. Sadly, or happily, only a few, whatever. Fortunately, most of our British friends are far too decent and intelligent. And I'm talking about Bobby McDonagh, who's former Irish ambassador to the EU, the UK, and Italy. And it has been said many a time that our own diplomatic service has done rather a good job up to now on the Brexit matter. Now, you were writing recently about something that is very worrying, which is the divergence between the two countries, the two next door neighbours.
Yes, Marion, thanks for having me on. Let me just say on that tweet that you read out, I've never had such a positive response from the UK. An awful lot of British people, you know, agree that British and Irish friendship should be maintained. And I did see in response a tweet that said UK government steps up no deal preparations by stockpiling people to blame. I think there's a certain amount of truth in that. But on your question, yes, clearly what probably brought Britain and Ireland closer together and led to the historic visit by the Queen more than anything else was our shared membership of the European Union. And the British people have voted to leave the European Union. And if that goes ahead, there's going to be a very serious divergence through no choice of our own. And I think the point I was making in the article that you refer to was that it's not just that we in Ireland have a different attitude and different values now in terms of multilateralism and international cooperation, but that the very elements that drove Brexit are shared by us, but we interpret them in a completely opposite way. So, for example, sovereignty was one of the great, you know, things that Nigel Farage was arguing for. We believe profoundly in sovereignty. You know, as Robert Emmet said, we should take our place among the nations of the earth. For us, sovereignty is deploying our sovereignty effectively. Or again, the Brexiteers talk about going global. We believe we're a very global country. But just look, for example, at the recent trade deal between the EU and Japan. The British are going to scramble around, if they leave Europe, to have a trade deal which won't be anything like as good as the deal that the European Union has. Taking control, well, we can see what sort of control Britain has on a daily basis now in Parliament. But we have far more control over our future, because on the international issues that are shared with our European partners, like international crime and trade and environment, we will have a seat at the table, but the British won't. So I don't say that in any sense of triumphalism, but I'm afraid it's a sad reality. But we, of course, have to work to maintain, insofar as we can in these circumstances, the British-Irish relationship.
It seems already that relations have deteriorated and that there's tit for tat going on and slagging going on across the Irish Sea in both directions. Now, admittedly, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Rees-Mogg speak in a particular fashion that some people find a tad irritating. They are entitled to their point of view, but of course we're entitled to pursue our own interests. So how do you stop that rift from developing?
Well, I think, to take your starting point, Marion, relations have deteriorated a bit since the Queen's visit. But let's not exaggerate. If you look at the great sweep of British-Irish history, relations aren't as bad as they were. And the Queen's visit was not just an event for one day. It was a historic event.
Yeah.
And the laying of a wreath in honour of people who died for Irish freedom and President McAleese laying a wreath with the Queen in honour of Irish people who died in British uniform was a historic
It was a key moment, I think.
Yeah. And a lot of the resonance of that remains. And British and Irish people still get on very well. Increasing numbers of British people are coming to live in Ireland and are very warmly welcomed here. But the problem that has arisen, if you like, arises from, as I said, first of all, our shared membership of the European Union is what largely brought us together, and now Britain is on a course to leave. It may do so. And the other thing which brought us together was the Northern Ireland peace process. And the deal that was reached in the withdrawal agreement is designed to preserve the balances of the Good Friday Agreement, but unfortunately that is again being questioned by the British government. So it's not surprising that there are challenges in the relationship, but I agree with the implication of your question. We should do everything we can to keep the relations as good as possible. But I also think that in a friendship, you have to be honest and you don't pull your punches.
And the other thing about it is, and I know that you feel this very strongly, English people are extraordinarily generous. I mean, you talk to people who were living in England during the Troubles and how very tolerant English people were as Irish people, though not in our name, were blowing English people to smithereens. And that, you know, I think life was difficult for Irish people because they were so conscious of it, but they were treated very well. I mean, Terry Wogan broadcast right throughout all of that, which must have been very difficult for him, but you never heard that spewing of hatred at him that you might expect now.
Yes, Marion, I was actually studying at university in England between 1972 and 1976, and I experienced no hostility, in fact, nothing but friendship from my British friends. I know other Irish people had quite different experiences in the UK, but there is a deeply civilised Britain. And I did, in one of my articles in the Irish Times, recount something, if you don't mind, I would repeat, that I visited with my wife the German war cemetery near Ypres, and there is only one German cemetery because, of course, they lost the war, and they have 26,000 soldiers, for example, in one grave. And on the day we visited,
they don't have individual graves.
They don't have individual graves. And on the day that we visited, we looked at the wreaths that had been laid on the German graves, and most of the wreaths had been left by British schools with inscriptions like, "In memory of brave people who died for their country, they did not die in vain." Some of them gone to the trouble of translating those messages into German, and it literally brought tears to my eyes. So there is a deeply civilised Britain, but on the other hand, you have, unfortunately, a different Britain, which has been given voice by Brexit, which is trying to refight the Second World War, and which is preposterously comparing the European Union to Hitler and so on. So, look, it's not all about us here. They have a really profound debate going on in the UK.
Right, and I mean, Europe has its other problems with France calling back the ambassador from Italy and all that. But following on from what Bobby was saying, wearing your integration, European integration, and Jean Monnet, he would turn in his grave, would he not, at this stage, Jean Monnet, to see what is going on?
I think he would, Marion, because people like him knew what war was about. They knew the cost of this kind of destruction, the divergence between states where problems could not be solved by anything other than violence. And There's just a taken for granted quality, I think, about the European Union and what it represents. There's always, I think, in Britain been this very erroneous idea that it was simply a common market. It wasn't. From the very beginning, this was a peace project.
Might it have been better to leave it as a common market?
Certainly not, because if you have any awareness of the history of international relations, especially in Europe, it is absolutely dogged by conflict. Whether it's between Britain and France or latterly Britain and Germany, you have great powers competing with each other, constant tensions that cannot be managed. What the European Union did was to turn all of that on its head. It provided a framework, a system whereby those tensions that crop up in all kinds of contexts, some of them very unanticipated, that they could be managed effectively. And just to go back to the point that Bobby made about Britain and Ireland, one of the reasons that our relationship blossomed because of joint membership is because officials like Bobby were able to meet their colleagues, not just in the European Council formally, but informally, to get to know each other. So there was an intensity about that process over time. You can see the same thing in the German-Polish relationship. The German-French relationship is so close, or has been, that in some international fora, they send one person to represent both countries. That is a staggering achievement relative to the carnage of history that was Europe before 1957.
Kevin?
I think part of the problem here, though, might be that in the whole Brexit scenario, Irish-English relationships or Anglo-Irish relationships have actually become Anglo-EU relationships, because Ireland is so intrinsically entangled with the EU 27 and have to be because they do the negotiating on Brexit. So I think what has largely happened is, whereas as two countries, Ireland and England, have worked very hard, and there was an interesting reference, the last time people in the UK would have seen Farmley House was when the Queen was staying there. Okay. And this week they see it when Theresa May is flying over for her beef dinner. And it was interesting because I was over in Brussels during the week for Donald Tusk's Special Place in Hell commentary on it. And you do wonder, I mean, Leo Varadkar is there standing beside Donald Tusk, almost having a giggle with him afterwards and telling him he's going to get in trouble in the UK press around that, which obviously played
out.
Which
was factual.
Very factual, to be fair. And then, you know, that there's that photograph of Leo Varadkar with Jean-Claude Juncker and that big thank you card from Ireland. And that all gets played back into the UK press as Ireland almost being a patsy. For the bad guys, the villains in Europe that have become the likes of Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker. Now, part of it is interesting because the backlash against Tusk, I thought, was fascinating to watch. There was about maybe 30 journalists in the room when he actually made that remark, and it was run-of-the-mill, kind of, they make statements, we expected him to say the backstop must stay, and then he kind of threw that in there. It was scripted. A few reports said it wasn't, but it was scripted at the very end, and there was maybe 7 or 8 Irish journalists, 10 UK media, and a smattering of journalists from across. But you could immediately see the UK journalists going, oh my God, it's an outrage, it's an outrage. And it was funny to watch it play out then in the UK media.
There are a number of articles in the papers today that are reminding us of what the EU did to us. And they are reminding us that the IMF were gentler on us than the EU were. That Jean-Claude Trichet, like, was no great pal.
He was going to set off a bomb in Dublin, was the quote.
You know, you have to bear those things in mind as well. And another one says they're going to come and get you, which will be on the tax.
Yeah, and it's often brought up, I think, by British commentators about who was the first to offer money when Ireland ran into trouble that time. It was the UK, and there was a row subsequently. We tried to pay them back early to cut the interest rates and they didn't want the money back. But there is that argument. But it is, I think, part of the reason that Anglo-Irish relations are so difficult at the minute is this reason that we're so on Team EU, and we have to be. So I think when this all filters out and when we figure it out, whether that's in March or whether that's in 2 years' time, I think Anglo-Irish relations will probably be easier to repair than many people, because we will go back to doing our own bilateral at that stage.
Alan?
Yeah, well, again, on the point about the future of Anglo-Irish relations, I mean, I think it's been well understood for a long time that if we can get over the withdrawal agreement bit and we move on to the negotiations around the future relationship, the old order will be restored, that Irish and British interests are going to be aligned to a much stronger position. Like I think Bobby will know much more about this than I will, but I mean, there's been this constant discussion amongst Irish officialdom that, you know, more than anybody else, we have the incentive to make sure that the free trade agreement is very, very robust. And so the alignment then, I think, will be really, really helpful. Yeah. And again, to pick up some of the issues that John has raised, that notion about ministerial and official level meetings. I mean, again, I've listened to British officials who will talk about this, that I guess, like, say, like the Nordics, and there are groups within certain, you know, geographic areas that make sure they do proactively
support one another.
But that's just, Bobby, one other question. One of the things that I have found interesting is the British have really shown a commitment to maintain the common travel area. Now, I remember when Brexit came on the agenda, even before the referendum, there were a number of people who were wondering, like, ironically, the common travel area was given its strongest legal definition by the European community.
Yeah.
Okay, so when Schengen was being established, Ireland and the UK were given a joint opt-out in recognition of the common travel area. And my understanding is that was one of the first times that the phrase was actually used, that it was one of these arrangements that existed much more in terms of custom and tradition than an actual legal underpinning. So when Brexit was happening and there was this, you know, this suggestion was being raised that maybe Ireland would be pulled into Schengen and that you would have this sort of thing dismantling. But every conversation, again, I've had with British officialdom, they seem very, very committed that all the positives that Ireland gets from the common travel area will remain. Right?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think the common travel area is an important interest that we will continue to share with the UK, and of course the European Union has also been very supportive of the continuation of the common travel area. So that isn't the issue. The issue now is, of course, the backstop. But I'd just like to make two comments on the various remarks that were made there. First of all, I don't think we should be unduly driven by the British media. I mean, it is true that some of the British media will present the Irish as the patsies, but sorry, there's nothing we can do about that.
Yeah.
The British media is not very often of a high quality. And the other is that, you know, I might not have made the remark that Tusk made in those circumstances, but it's nothing like as bad as the comparisons that have been made by members of Theresa May's government, and indeed her party, although not by herself, comparing the European Union to Hitler and comparing it to the Soviet Union. I mean, Tusk spent a large part of his life very bravely trying to overturn totalitarianism. So,
and that was Jeremy Hunt, who we kind of think is reasonably sound of mind.
Maybe he snapped a little bit, but maybe it's understandable. The other thing is just, Marion, to go back, you know, you often refer, I know in your programme, which I enjoy, to the financial crisis. Now, the European Union probably made mistakes, and we made mistakes at the time, but our membership of the European Union does not boil down to mistakes made at the time of the financial crisis and Europe supporting us now, and it will continue to support us now. We have had 50 years of membership where we have... I've spent 30 of those years not defending Europe in Ireland, but defending Ireland in Europe, where we have proven that we can defend our interests effectively in the context of a negotiation process that is respectful and in a context in which our European partners have been sympathetic to our concerns at the same time as defending their concerns.
Right, Maureen?
I think, you see, one of the things that's happening here is that everybody is losing perspective. I couldn't agree more with what Bobby said, is that, you know, we have a very old alliance with Britain, a set of alliances, you know, which like shift in tone every so often with Britain, but also with the EU. And they go through bad periods and good periods, and I think they'll settle down. I mean, I'm optimistic in the long term that they will settle down, because it's in all our interests that they settle down. But there's always going to be spats. But the thing I think that people have lost sight of is that what we're seeing is a post-traumatic disorder working out at political level as a result of the financial crisis. The financial crisis deeply unsettled people and really put page
terrified
to the,
people
and put page
and
to
made
their
misery
dreams,
of their
you
lives,
know,
yeah.
the way they the expectations of their lives, and I think what we're seeing now is that post-traumatic disorder playing out. And one of the things that happens in that kind of scenario in an individual is that you lose perspective, you know, that you fragment. And this is what's happening. And I think the Rees-Moggs of this life, that little rump of Brexiteers, were always sealed off from Ireland. They're stuck somewhere in a buccaneering sort of colonial view of Britain. And, you know, frankly, if they all floated out to sea, I think we'd all be better off, you know.
There'd be no violence on this programme. Absolutely. It just reminds us of Donald Tusk's past. It's a very interesting band because some of us are a bit sceptical and worried that we might be thrown under a bus yet. But you think he's particularly supportive of us because of his own background.
Yes, Marion. He was born in 1957. He comes from a really interesting minority called the Kashubian minority in Poland. Now, they're a minority because they speak a slightly different dialect. But the key thing is that he was born in a border region. So he has a real sensibility about ethnic difference and about what it is to try and negotiate your life in a border area. He was born in the city of Gdansk. His father was a carpenter. His mother, I think,
was a teacher.
Was a nurse.
A nurse.
Interestingly.
Yeah.
And so he understands what it's like to live in a frontier area. And he has this sense of complex historical identities and how they can be kind of reconciled and so on. But it's also important to remember, I think, that he was a very successful prime minister of Poland. In the 1990s, Poland went through a terribly unsettled period, prime minister after prime minister, government after government.
And this
is the first one that was elected twice.
He started in solidarity. I mean, we all knew Lech Walesa, but we didn't know him as well. So his history, you could see why it might align in some way. And he was very successful as a politician.
He was a student organizer, not with the same profile as Lech Walesa and others, but he became one of the kind of centre-right kind of took on various iterations in the 90s, but it settled into a party called Civic Platform. But that in itself encouraged a kind of reaction in Poland, and that led to the election of the Law and Justice government, which is by any categorization, a far-right party, an uber-nationalist
party.
And one of that important things about Tusk's background is he really does seem to have a distaste for nationalism, or nationalism of the extreme kind propagated by the Law and Justice Party in Poland. He's been at odds with that Polish government for a very long time.
Patricia, just to go back to you and living in England, and part of what Bobby was saying there, and relations and all of that.
I would have to say I shared the same experience as Bobby. I lived in the UK for 11 years and I worked in three different hospitals, mostly around London or outside of London. And although I was acutely aware, because I was there 87 to 97, I was acutely aware of the Guildford 4 and the Birmingham 6.
It was very.
And I worked in St. Thomas's in Westminster there for 5 years. So you were across the road from the Houses of Commons. I had to pass by Whitehall and Downing Street on my way home from work every evening. I had to cross over the bridge, go in front of the House of Commons. And during my tenure there, there were several bombs in Downing Street, none that resulted in fatalities. I also worked with a registrar in obstetrics whose father was a politician who was blown up by an IRA bomb. And I was shown extraordinary civility and, you know, certainly after a big issue with the IRA, you would moderate your accent going into work the next morning.
You're
very conscious of your Irish accent. But I was never, ever shown any sort of distaste or anything being an Irish person. And I remember wondering, would I be so forgiving if I was in Ireland? And, you know, well, obviously there was things happening here north of Ireland as well. So
dreadful,
if I lived in Northern Ireland and I was at the a victim of some of those atrocities, I find it extraordinary that people can be as kind and as gracious as they were, and as obviously as the Irish were, to the English in Northern Ireland in similar circumstances.
Well, I mean, if you take it, I mean, you were talking about the Good Friday Agreement and how important it is, but we now realise that 20 years on, sectarianism thrives.
Ready to bubble. Yes,
absolutely.
It still drives politics in Northern Ireland, which is after two decades is devastating. I know Karen Bradley got in trouble for saying she didn't realise that nationalists don't vote for unionists and unionists don't vote for nationalists. And it's astonishing that 20 years on, nothing has found that middle ground. In fact, if anything, the SDLP have been squeezed out.
Well, they have, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised, as I said yesterday, about Bertie Ahern, because he really didn't want anything moved on a border poll until that had moved, you know, and that relationships had developed and respect. Yes, Patricia.
I listening to the dialogue over the last few weeks and months, and we're listening to Brexit now for 2 years, and it is Groundhog Day, and whilst I had a lot of admiration for Theresa May's resilience, you know, I used to wonder every morning, how does that woman get up and go to work every day and face all that nonsense that she has to put up with? But in recent weeks, and particularly after the turn back, you begin to wonder if they've got fixation error, and that happens in healthcare, where people just become fixated on the problem and can't move from it. And I think we need to show some sort of help. And I reflect on the negotiations that took place for the Good Friday Agreement and wish some of those skills were more evident. I am uncomfortable with the level of smugness in terms of, and I know people don't mean anything about it, but the remarks and the card, they should be done in private. I don't think that should be television. I don't think it's helpful to us or to Britain to have that in highlights. I think our communication needs to be respectful. The content, tone and style needs to be, well thought out and considered in these negotiations.
Kevin, I'll come back to you in a second, Bobby. Yes, Kevin.
On the Theresa May point, I think something that the past week has epitomised quite well is that we crossed the 50-day barrier to Brexit, This entire week was an absolute waste of time.
Absolutely.
It was nothing one big photo op for Theresa May, and she's going over, she's fighting with her own guys, then she's going to Belfast, then she's going to Brussels, and then she's coming to Dublin. And it she is a bit like that neighbour that you're all twitching at the curtains when you see her coming, going, oh God, turn off the lights, she'd think we're not here. And you know, and she's coming around, she doesn't even have a bottle of wine or a packet of Marietta biscuits for you, but she comes and she stays all evening and you want to go to bed and she won't leave. And it has almost a tragic element to it. And now we're going to go back to the House of Commons, and I think it'll be Thursday probably when the votes happen again, and we're going to probably end up on Friday with Valentine's Day massacre headlines in all the papers again, because we'll have got nowhere else.
Yeah. Bobby.
Thanks to Marion, and there are so many points I'd like to make in response to those interesting points, but I'd just like to take the one you made about the fear that we'd be thrown under a bus. Mm. I think it's really important to understand that we will not be thrown under a bus, and that's not just because of the issue itself, it's because the idea that somehow Ireland is going to be abandoned at the last minute is profoundly affecting the debate in the House of Commons. Mm. Basically, Theresa May, provided she doesn't really intend to crash out of the European Union, and she's not mad, so I don't think she does, although she's running a risk by playing a bit of chicken on it, and assuming she's not going to move towards the majority view of having a second referendum, she has two choices. One is to tack to the right, which is to get on board Jacob Rees-Mogg and so on. And that involves keeping her own deal in play, the deal that was negotiated and which largely shaped by her, and to get the Irish backstop changed. The other option is to tack to the centre, to tack to where the majority of members of the House of Commons are, where Jeremy Corbyn, with all his faults, has recently indicated an openness. Now, if the impression is created, as some of the British media do, presumably on the basis of briefing, that, you know, her visit to Dublin, which was wonderfully warm, and that's very good that it was, but somehow there's a bit of a negotiation opening up. That is really important, because there wasn't. There was no negotiation. Yeah. And the negotiation will start again on Monday, but it will not be about the withdrawal agreement or the backstop. Yeah. So I think we owe it to our British friends to be clear that the withdrawal agreement will not be changed. And that is not because the Commission says it, it's not because we say it, it's because all the 27 democratically elected governments of the EU say it.
Okay, before we leave Europe, I want to come back to you, John, and I've read a number of articles about this, that we're so fixated about Brexit, because it is very important to us, that we're missing a bigger picture of what's going on in Europe and what's going on with Italy and what's going on with France and what's going on further east. And, I mean, Italy is not in a great nick at the moment.
No, Liam Weeks of UCC has a very good piece. I think it's in The Independent today about this very point. Now, to some extent, I think this is inevitable, you know, that all the political oxygen would be sucked up because Brexit is absolutely existential for our island. But I don't think it's true to suggest that our diplomats have taken their eyes off the game.
No, I'm not saying that, but perhaps the rest of society.
Perhaps so. We're coming into a European election in May. I think it'll be an absolutely critical one. You're absolutely right that the situation has got worse in Italy. It's almost unprecedented to have the kind of breakdown in relations where an ambassador is withdrawn, the French ambassador to Italy. So that's right. Those
just
tensions are there.
Just to explain to people why that was done?
Well, it was done because people from the governing party coalition
governing
in Italy
party,
turn up in Paris at these protests. French government, understandably, is very unhappy with that. Now, I think those tensions can be managed and they can be managed at EU level. But the bigger thing, I think, is about what happens to the European institutions after the elections. What do those elections portend? Do we end up with a hugely increased far-right bloc, which historically has actually struggled to cohere into an effective unit? But if we do get something like that, it will change the contours of power in Europe, because the European Parliament, remember, is a co-legislator in most areas now with the Council of Ministers. So these elections are critically important in May. I suspect that they'll be more important in other countries than they are in Ireland because of those populist kind of reflexes that are flowing through so many jurisdictions.
So many. Just one last question to you, Bobby. Deal or no deal?
Well, I think deal, yes, because no deal would be damaging for everybody, including Ireland and Europe, but particularly for the UK. And I think there's an overwhelming majority of people in the House of Commons, including Theresa May, who want a deal. The question is the nature of the deal. And as I say, the choice there is either to... I mean, the European Union has negotiated in good faith. There is a deal there. She can try and get that through. She can maybe look for clarifications
of
it.
She can't, not as it is.
Well, she can... Well, what the European Union has said is that the declaration on the future political relationship between the EU and the UK can be negotiated, and that, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn, many people in the House of Commons believe that that's where the adjustments will be needed in order to get the deal through. That's where the choice is, and I believe there will be a deal.
Yeah. Okay. On that optimistic note, may I thank you. That's former Irish Ambassador to EU, to UK and Italy, Bobby McDonagh, and we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucan Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme. We've been talking about appalling vistas here now, and it's nothing to do with what you think. It's to do with Cheltenham. The racing world in the UK is very upset. All race meets were stopped last week due to an outbreak of equine flu. It's hoped they'll resume again this Wednesday. Equine flu is not in this country at the moment, but what implications does this outbreak have for Irish trainers and jockeys and owners and connections and all of those who trail around after them? And what of Cheltenham just around the corner next month? I'm joined by Brenda McArdle from the Irish Field and also RTE's racing commentary. Brendan, the British Horse Racing Authority had a statement out yesterday. What were they saying?
Well, good morning, Marion. It's certainly looking much better than it was, say, last Friday, Marion, in terms of all the tests that they have done since. It's still only the same number of reactors that have come back positive, and that's the six horses from Donald McLean's yard that have tested positive. So this is looking good, but we're still not out of the grass yet. There's still a lot of work to be done. And there's a lot of testing to be done, and until everything gets back to normal, then we don't know what's going to happen between now and Cheltenham. Hopefully Cheltenham will go ahead.
Just to put it in context, would it be excessive to say this is like the equivalent of foot and mouth disease in cattle?
Well, it's certainly... It's the Florida Clade 1 strain, which was first identified back in 1963 in Miami, and The problem here is that you have horses that are actually, which are vaccinated, and this particular strain is actually breaking through the vaccination. So, say from February the 18th here in Ireland, any horse that hasn't, that's not vaccinated and contains the clade 1 cover, they won't be allowed to run. So the Irish authorities are doing their very best to minimise this, to make sure it doesn't get into this country and to leave Ireland disease-free.
Right. Well, if you take the notion of Cheltenham, there's going to be an invasion of Irish people, Irish horses, etc., fairly shortly. I just remember that when we had foot and mouth, everything was just clamped down and no movement allowed.
And that would be the same case here, Marion, if the authorities, the BHA and also the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board don't agree that it's safe for horses to go racing and for horses from Ireland to travel to Britain to participate. So it's a nervous time for a lot of owners, trainers, breeders, jockeys, the industry as a whole. But I think they're all working very closely with the authorities here to make sure, like for instance, at Naas yesterday and at Punchestown today, there's an extra vet on checking the horses that are entering the grounds this morning. Also, there is disinfected areas, there's boot wash areas. Like, they're taking all the precautionary here that's needed to make sure that we stay disease-free. But it's really on the far side of the water that we need to be looking at,
right,
and making sure that there's no more positive cases there.
Right.
And if they can have contained it to where it is at the moment with Donald McLean, then hopefully in 2 weeks' time it'll all be free to go again.
And what's in 2 weeks' time? That's kind of, as it were, an incubation period?
An incubation period. That's what they're saying. But as in, if there's no more cases between now and next Wednesday, then the BHA look like they're going to resume racing again, maybe in certain areas. But there's been a number of different trainers in England, like Nigel Twist and Davis, being really vocal about the authorities have been too quick to stop racing, and that this is not as a big an epidemic as they might see. But the BHA were very quick, they're very decisive, and they've decided that no racing until they're disease-free.
OK. We will leave it there for the moment. Actually, the Irish trainer, Gordon Elliott, had some horses racing at Ayr, but his horses have tested negative. You're obviously very keen about Cheltenham.
Racing, Marion, I have for since I was a child. I think this is really important, but the other dimension to this is breeding. Irish breeding is really interconnected with English breeding in particular, and we're about to see the start of the season.
Yeah.
If you take Coolmore Stud in County Tipperary, it's a world leader, and you would see a huge procession of mares coming from leading studs in England to their leading sires.
To be covered.
The
right.
value of money involved here is staggering, potentially, if that was to be interrupted.
Okay, we will leave it there and we will take a break. Welcome back to the programme. Well, it's birthday time again, and Sky News is marking its 30th birthday this year. Its launch marked the advent here, I suppose, in the foots of CNN, in the feet of CNN indeed, even, the 24-hour news cycle. And the question is that a good thing or a bad thing? It certainly was part of the movement of the way news is consumed. And I'm joined now by Roddy Flynn, Associate Professor from the School of Communications in Dublin City University, and you're very, very welcome indeed. How much of a change did Sky make? It didn't take off, did it, at the beginning?
No, it was slow to do so, and in fact, if you look at its viewership figures now, they're still fairly low in terms of overall television. You know, less than 1% of the Irish population is watching it at any given moment in time. But it took a while. It was kind of a lost leader as far as the Murdoch organisation was concerned. News is still a lost leader in point of fact. It costs more to produce than it'll ever take. But it's got prestige attached to it, so that's, you know, kind of why they basically stuck with it. And as the rest of the kind of Sky organisation started making money in the 1990s, they were able to kind of, you know, cross-subsidise it, basically, yeah. From elsewhere. So yeah, it took its time, but it's almost impossible to remember just how different news looked before kind of Sky came along.
Remind people.
Well, I mean, people in the studio will remember it. I remember myself. Basically, you've got like three forms of kind of news content. And the main one is the news anchor reading off a pre-kind of read script. And the second part, I suppose, of that is an edited package that has been done in advance. And like from my, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, so I remember people like, you know, Don Coburn and whatever, just kind of sternly reading the news and telling you this is how it is, and maybe very occasionally cutting to an edited package. And that was the kind of variety that you had, right? And then whatever, News for the Deaf and the kind of and the weather. Then Sky kicks in, and what it, the key thing I think it introduces is what we call the live two-way. So you have a back and forth basically between the studio, the anchor there, and the somebody who's on site.
The reporter in the field.
The reporter in the field. Or even the reporter who's been in the field coming back into the studio to have a kind of face-to-face conversation there. And so that kind of mixes things up a bit. And what you're getting there is a different kind of conversation. It's less about this is what has happened today, although that's still there, but it's also a kind of, it's a lot of projecting forward, right? It's a lot of speculative stuff about what does this all mean? Where are we likely to be in 5 hours' time? And that's the kind of thing that really hadn't been a feature of television news up to that point.
Yeah. And did it evolve or was it a conscious decision? Or, like, I remember the first time that going to somebody else's house to watch the news was kind of, they had coverage on the White House with in the Russian changeover. Do you remember the attack on the White House when Yeltsin was when that changeover was
the
gone?
Russian White House. I thought you meant him at Washington. Sorry.
No. In Russia, and like it was just unbelievable because you were watching it live on television. She couldn't leave the room.
Yeah.
And it's those are the kind of things it's good at.
Yeah, I mean, immediacy is obviously it's kind of its stock in trade and its currency. The problem, I suppose, though, with that is that it arguably a trump, you know, speed and kind of immediacy would trump accuracy. And you're going to ask, like, is that something that kind of gradually emerge? No, it's there from day one because it kind of has to be. Because the problem, obviously, with news is it doesn't present itself in neatly packaged, pre-organized and predictable kind of chunks. So you kind of have to adjust to the fact that the possibility there's not much happening just at the moment. So we have to fill in the space.
Yeah, you know? And they do repeat the same stuff over and over. And if you wanted to come in and then I'll come around here.
No, well, just, I mean, I suppose one of the indicators of success of CNN and then Sky is the fact that everybody then got in on the act. So you know, BBC 24, Bloomberg, even good old RTE, they all do it. And I like it because, you know, there's a group of us who are news junkies and the idea of being able to sort of sit down at any point and pick up is quite good, but the one thing I'll say, I think the effect they've had, the change in the nature of the meaning of the term breaking news, because again I'm looking at it today. Do you remember we were kids and like if there was a news flash, it actually meant something big had happened. And I still find it's almost like a Pavlovian reaction or whatever like that, that if I see something like breaking news, I automatically think, oh, this is something big,
really big.
And of course invariably now it's not.
Maureen?
Well, I mean, I see absolutely why that live coverage, you know, is so addictive. But that is its problem, is that we do pay a very big price for this immediacy.
And superficiality?
Yes. One price is that the human brain is attuned to bad news because that's a, you know, it's a threat. And so all of the breaking news tends to be, you know, about bad news. So we have very good evidence that people who consume a lot of TV news, in other words, they're there constantly tuning in, that it has all kinds of, you know, unfortunate psychological effects. It makes them more pessimistic. It makes them more anxious, etc. We have the same evidence coming through now about social media.
Right.
And I also think that the quality of analysis has deteriorated because if you have to do it every hour, you know, where's the perspective?
That's worth saying. They were very lucky, Sky, in the timing of their launch. 1989, after all, was a revolutionary year. And I remember watching it vividly. Tiananmen Square, remember, in Beijing. And then all of the events in Eastern Europe, the flow of people from East Germany to Hungary. And then later in the year, dramatically, the fall of the Berlin Wall. And as if that wasn't enough, on Christmas Day, we had the Ceausescus
killed
subject to a mock trial. And we saw their grisly bodies. That was really a salutary change for, you know, the way we actually watched news.
Yeah.
And I think then if you look at their coverage in Bosnia, for example, in the 1990s, they did some very, very good work. But I just remember 1989.
Right.
It's amplified by that coverage. It was really important.
Okay, Roddy, they say, you know, they,
yeah,
that if you want to know what Murdoch's thinking, you read The Sun.
Mm.
How much did Murdoch place his editorial print on that?
Yeah, I think far less so. I mean, as you say, The Sun was utterly unambiguous, you know, kind of. So during the 80s, it's Thatcher, and then after the deal with Tony Blair in 1995, it's a shift towards New Labour. You'd be harder pressed to see overt evidence of that, although, I mean, anecdotally, my own kind of feeling is when I look at kind of Sky, I see more of the anchor's opinion kind of drifting across, if only kind of anecdotally. But and the tendency might be to think that Sky is more conservative, even more reactionary, let's say. And some of the figures, people like Kay Burley, has a tendency to kind of let slip the kind of the mask occasionally and kind of say what she really thinks of the Great Unwashed. That said, Adam Bolton, who's there, you know, been the political editor since kind of day one, is actually of sort of Labour DNA. And it's not widely known, but like he's married to Angie Hunter, who is one of Tony Blair's kind of leading political advisors. His first marriage was to the daughter, I think, of a Labour minister. So he's in that space.
So you're saying
But there is, you know, he's of that. So it was far less clear. And I think, I suppose, the strength of the established kind of news brands that they were competing against, BBC and ITV going back to 1955, made that much, much harder to kind of to take a more partisan view. Whereas with newspapers, that had always been the case. They were inherently partisan.
Yeah.
And at least it's not Fox.
Kevin, but mind you, let's clarify, Murdoch doesn't own it anymore. That's the end of many a row in our household this and that. 24-hour news, what it has done to news, to papers, you know, to television. It kind of was before social media, as Maureen was saying, but it really set the changes in motion.
Yeah, you could call it an infection, if you like, and it has spread everywhere. And it is, I think it's exhausting for us that work day to day in journalism. And it must also be a bit exhausting for the people who consume it, because you can't, from the time you get up in the morning to the time you go to bed at night, the story moves now, but no longer by the hour, but nearly by the minute. And you've seen, I suppose, what Sky brought to that 24-hour news on television, the internet has now brought to print, to something that was always sacrosanct, that you wrote your story and you sat on it and it should be on the front page tomorrow and you deal with the fallout. Now you put it up online and you immediately deal with the fallout on social media, and obviously then that feeds back into the broadcasters and it all kind of, it's symbiotic, but it can also be somewhat toxic nearly, because it all happens so fast.
And I mean, to a certain extent, Donald Trump is right about fake news. I mean that's why Storyful and all of those were set up, because and as we saw from Cambridge Analytica, you can't trust your sources anymore
There is still a cohort of journalists that can absolutely be trusted, and media outlets that can absolutely be trusted. But you're right in that, and maybe this touched on something Roddy said, it can often be more that the opinion has slipped in to the news rather than the stern man reading you the bare facts.
Okay, another day, another dollar. We could spend an hour on this. Roddy, thank you very, very much indeed for coming in. And thank you to everybody who contributed to the programme today. And that's all we have time for. On sound today, Damien Chanel. On our researcher was Rachel Breslin. Broadcast coordinator was Bridget Nicholas. And today's producer was the series producer, Margaret Curley. That's all from us and from all of us here. A very good day to you.